So please help me give a warm welcome to our speaker tonight from Baltimore, Maryland, Kathy P.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. I'm Kathy. I'm an alcoholic. Dental lights, romantic. My sobriety date is June 15th, 2001. I have a home group, Primary Purpose Speakers Group in Bel Air, Maryland. I do have a sponsor that I rely on heavily. I don't care how long you've been sober, crazy comes back quickly. I sponsor other women in this program. And I'm sober today only because of God's grace and because of the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll just try to tell you my story and what it was like and how I got here and what it's like today. And God hasn't shown up yet, so you're going to have to bear with me until he kicks in. Anyway, I started out my life with a really normal family. I've got a wonderful family. I grew up in this beautiful home, a little town about 20 miles north of Boston. And yeah, you probably figured that out by now. speech impediment. You're born with it. You're stuck with it. But I had a really good life. Really good family. All my needs were met. Pretty much all my wants were met. We were not rich by far, but my parents are really good, moral, ethical people. The kind of people that wanted to, you know, go without so that the kids could have the best of everything, you know. I never saw that, of course, but I always start out whenever I talk anywhere by telling that about how I had such a normal life. You know, my parents were married for 49 years. I'm the oldest of three. I got a younger brother and sister. Life was good. And the reason that I start out that way isn't really for your benefit. It's for mine. It's to remind me that there's nothing external that I can blame my alcoholism on. I was born with this. This is mine and mine alone. There was nothing that I could point to that I could say that did it. That was what made me an alcoholic. You know, there was no divorce, no broken home, no abuse, no, there's no alcoholism in my family anywhere. I mean, I don't know how that works, but it's got to start somewhere, I guess, but I'm it, you know, but I know that I was born this way, and I used to hear people when I first got sober, I'd be going to meetings, and I heard people from podiums talking about how they were born an alcoholic, and how did that work? You know, I mean, you don't pop out of the womb sucking on JD, you know? I mean, how are you born an alcoholic? But I absolutely get it today because the rest of the world out there, Webster's Dictionary, Wikipedia, you know, you look up the definition of alcoholism and they define alcoholism as an inability to stop drinking. But the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that I'm an alcoholic because I suffer from a spiritual malady. And that's how I can say I was born with this thing, because I was broken since conception. You know, I was one seriously twisted sister. I did not think like the other kids. I didn't act like the other kids. I didn't like the other kids. And they didn't like me, and I was fine with that. You know, I was the weird little kid in the corner walking in circles and talking to the wall. And nobody wanted to play with me, and I liked it that way because I thought they were all dorks, you know. But then I'd go home and I'd cry because I had no friends, you know. I was, like, demented. But when you're a little kid and you know there's something wrong with you and you don't know what's wrong with you, you kind of instinctively know that you shouldn't share that with anyone. So I didn't, you know. I didn't tell anyone how I felt inside. But because I was living in such self-centered fear, I couldn't let you know that I hurt. So what that made me was a big fat actress. You know, I wore a lot of masks. I had a lot of faces I put on to make sure that you knew I was okay. That would work, by the way, a little bit of the time. You know when you're in school, you got all those cliques, you know? You got the jocks and the geeks and the freaks and the band people and the heads. You know, that's what we call the druggies, the potheads. Love those guys. They were my favorite. But I didn't fit into any clique. I fit into all of them. I had to, because I couldn't stand for you not to like me. I couldn't stand disapproval. So I would act however I needed to act, depending on who I was with. And if I was with one group of kids, you know, like I was a cheerleader and really jockey and preppy and annoying, and I'd be acting one way with them, and it was okay if it was just them. But drop me in a social situation, you know, school dance, school cafeteria, beach party, you know, and I'm with one group of people and acting one way, and then up come walking the heads, you know, and they're my friends too. And then which way do you act? You know, which face do you put on? Which mask do you wear? I was always looking over my shoulder. I was in constant fear because one of you was going to figure me out for the phony that I was. And I was terrified. And it's exhausting keeping up an act like that all the time. But I was never comfortable with me. I just wanted to be anything or anybody other than me. It was rough when I was young. And this was way before I ever picked up a drink. You know, this is how broken I was before. See, because the alcohol, I found out, was my solution. I remember my first drunk. I was 14 years old. I went to a beach party. I was with some older cousins. They were 16 and 17. They both drove. I thought they were cool, and I had to make them like me, you know. My mother thought I was safe because I was with family members. Poor decision on her part. But we went to this beach party, and everybody's drinking. And I made a conscious decision to get drunk that night so that I would fit in. I can't honestly say that I thought that first drink was going to do anything for me, you know, that my world was going to change, everything was going to be upended. I just drank to fit in. But when the alcohol hit me for the first time, oh, my God, I found my solution for living, you know. I found my answer. That fixed everything. I didn't know until that night when the alcohol hit me for the first time that I had been living my entire life with a giant fist around my ribcage until the alcohol hit me and it released its grip and I could breathe, you know? And the noise in my head was deafening. I was one of those people that could never sleep. I would stare at the clock all night long. Remember those old things that they used to flip over, remember? I know I'm dating myself, but I would stare at that thing all night long, and I'd be like, if I fall asleep right now, I'll get 5.5 hours sleep. And then 15 minutes later, if I fall asleep right now, you know, I could never sleep because I couldn't quiet the noise. I couldn't turn it off. And what the noise was resentments. I would relive them and replay them over and over and keep them alive and feed them and nurture them like they were my children, you know. I would... So crazy I was. I would relive fights from like 5 years ago, trying to change the outcome somehow, or pre-fight fights that hadn't happened yet. You know, stand in the bathroom mirror, play both roles. Ever do that? I mean, batshit. But that night, when the alcohol hit me for the first time, what I was getting was static. It was like white noise. It was peaceful, and that was what I sought. The big book says that we drink for the effect the alcohol produces. That was the effect I saw. I hear a lot of people from a lot of podiums talking about how when the alcohol hit them the first time, they got taller and smarter and better looking and became better dancers and their acne fell off and all that stuff. And I believe that to be true because I hear that from a lot of people, but that wasn't my experience. You know, I was still short and fat and uncoordinated, but the difference was I didn't care what you thought anymore. It gave me peace. I found something that made me feel that incredible. Why wouldn't I do that as often as possible? You know, and I went out. That was my mission in life, to get drunk as often as I could. But when you're 14, you know, it's not always easy to get your hands on liquor. There's a lot of other non-conference approved stuff that's a lot more accessible. So what that makes me is a garbage head. You know, anything you got, I'll take just to get me out of me. I was that girl. I would like walk into a house party and someone would say, open your mouth, and they'd flip in a pill, you know, and I wouldn't ask what it was. I didn't care. Anything to get me out of me. Oh, it was the 70s. It was usually something hallucinogenic. I miss mushrooms. I don't think there's anything out there that I haven't tried, except heroin, because that's addictive. But I tried to... tried to find freedom, you know, freedom from the bondage of self. But you don't know what's wrong with you. You know, I tried all the things. I tried all the things the big book says that we do to fix ourselves. I was so glad when I finally read the thing and found out there were other people like me. I tried the geographic relocation. That doesn't work. No matter where you go, there you are. You know, you bring you with you. And we find the same people. You know, it's always the same people. Different names, different faces. But we find our people. And the trouble starts all over again. And then you got to move again. I tried, the prestige, you know. I got the kick-ass job. I had the business cards. I had the company credit card. I traveled all over the country. Thought I'd arrived, you know. It doesn't fix you. It's just a job. Now I'm married to my job, and I have no life, and I'm drinking constantly because I can't fall asleep on my own. I have to pass out to get any rest. So I'm drinking around the clock. The job didn't fix me. I thought I needed stuff. My parents been happy. Their whole lot. They've got nice stuff. Maybe I need my own stuff. I was living in Virginia at the time. I bought a beautiful condo, filled it with beautiful furniture. You know, paintings on the walls. I had the clothes, the jewelry, the latest technology, which at that point was probably an 8-track. I had the bitchin' Camaro, you know? I had everything that should have made me happy if stuff is my problem. But it's just stuff. It doesn't fix you. It doesn't fill the hole in your soul. It certainly doesn't comfort you when you're scared or alone. It's just stuff. And when you're drunk like me, your stuff gets old in a minute and you need new stuff, you know? So that didn't work. But, see, I'm keeping in touch with the people that I graduated high school with, because I got to make sure they know how great I'm doing. My greatest fear was that they would find out I wasn't fabulous and lying through my teeth about how wonderful I am, and I can't get through a day without a blackout. I'm a blackout drinker. I black out every time I drink. But I think that's why I drank, because I like the blackout. I want to check out. I don't want to feel. Feelings are awful. But... see, all those girls, now I'm in my late 20s by this time. All those girls I graduated high school with are all married up. They all got houses and kids, and I thought, that's what I need. Haven't tried the guy yet, you know? That's actually how I ended up living in Maryland. I was on a business trip to Baltimore, and I went to a bar one night, because that's where you find Mr. Wright, and there he was holding up the wall, and I thought, that's the one. I'm going to marry that guy. And I did, 6 months later. I don't recommend that. That was bad. I look back on it now and try to think about what it was that attracted me to him. Because he wasn't the most handsome man I ever met, or the funniest, or the richest. I mean, he wasn't even the nicest guy I ever met. I think what it was is he was a bigger drunk than I was. At that point in my life, I was wicked proud of the fact that I could drink any guy I knew under the table. Like, that's something to aspire to. But this guy, he was a sun-up to sundown alcoholic. You know, he started drinking the minute his feet hit the floor. And I think I stayed with him as long as I did, because being with an alcoholic meant I didn't have to look at me. I didn't have to take my own accountability, you know. Everything was his fault. He was the reason that we were getting turn-off notices. We couldn't pay our bills. He was the reason that I was unhappy. I blame my unhappiness on this man. Like anybody is responsible for my happiness. I even blame my drinking on him. You know, because in the beginning, you know, we drank to celebrate our newfound love. And then we drank, I think, to tolerate each other. And then we just drank. And it was ugly. I should have left. You know, if I was smart, I would have left. But... I'm a nice little Irish Catholic girl. My family doesn't take kindly to divorce. And I was living in such self-centered fear, I didn't know how to call them and tell them I made a mistake, I'm leaving. So I decided to fix the marriage any way I could. And I did what any good drunk would do and brought a couple kids in the situation, you know? Think about that. How horrible is that? My kids were born with a job. They were supposed to make me happy. Who does that? I'd love to stand up here and tell you that I was a good mom, but I'd be lying, and I don't have to do that today. I was a horrible mother. Those kids, they're so lucky that they didn't die in neglect. I couldn't spend any time with them. I was never around them. But one thing I can tell you honestly is that those kids have never seen me take a drink. And God willing, I hope they never will. At least that they know of, anyway. There was that wonderful invention, the travel mug, you know. So I'd tell them it was coffee in there, and they're like, Mom, can we have a sip? And I'm like, oh, hot, you know. And you can hear the ice rattling in the thing, you know. But don't think, though, that a day went by that those kids didn't suffer from the effects of my alcoholism. Because, see, I wouldn't drink in front of them, because I thought that's what a good mom does. You don't drink in front of your kids. So what that made them was in my way, and I couldn't spend any time with them. And I was always chasing them out of my way because I had better things to do with my time. I would wake up wherever I had passed out the night before. Usually the kids would wake me up, and always with a bottle of Motrin. You know, these kids could barely read and write, but they knew what a migraine was. They knew when not to bother Mom. I'd throw back a handful of Motrin, wash it down with the hair of the dog, and throw clothes on them, stuff oatmeal cookies in their pockets and call it breakfast, because oatmeal's breakfast food. And then I'd push them on the bus and get back to my real job, you know, my top priority. They would come home from school and it would be go outside and play. You need fresh air. But what it really was is Mom needs a drink while she's cooking dinner. And then it would be, you know, come in, wash your hands, eat your dinner, do your homework, take a bath, go to bed. And I would chase them to bed way before they needed to go to bed. No tucking them in, no bedtime stories, you know, no spending time with them at all. And see, kids get older and they get smarter and they learn how to tell time. And they're like, really, Mom? It's 6 o'clock. It's still light out, you know. And my response was, well, usually something that I can't repeat from the podium. And I'd chase them down the hallway with a hairbrush and tell them that they were getting on my damn nerves. And that's who I turn into. That's what this thing does to me. I become a monster. I have this one story that I'll share with you. Came back to me. Thank God, not in early recovery, because it has set me sprinting to the liquor store. The big book says that more will be revealed. They mean that shit. I had this memory of doing the dishes one night and my little daughter playing by my side. And she wasn't even talking to me. She was just playing quietly with one of her toys. And I was drying things and putting things away. And I reached over her head to put something away. And when I reached, my little girl ducked. There's only one reason kids duck. That's who I turn into, you know? Nobody wants to be that mom. I didn't want to be that mom. But see, when I hurt inside, I can't see you. And I don't care how I have to run over to get what I need. And our life was hell. And I could see that I was torturing those kids. I finally left after 11 years with that man. And I wish I could say I left for the right reasons, but I left because I was going to save my kids from the alcoholic, you know, still not looking at me. And, you know, we have all those delusions of grandeur. Everything's going to get better. I saw myself moving into this little apartment, you know, but I saw myself doing all these good things with them, you know, taking them to the park, playing board games with them, laughing, you know. I had all these visions in my head. I had all the best of intentions, but we're not judged on our intentions, you know. We're judged on our actions. And I'm still not spending any time with them. And the thing about this apartment I moved into, there were other single mothers in the complex, and they had teenage daughters, so there's babysitters all over the place. And I'm out every night of the week. You know, now I don't need an excuse. Now I have no one to be accountable to. I'm out every night. My kids went from mom they were afraid of to absent mom, and my kids are being raised by other kids. Thank God, right about that time, God intervened in the form of two state troopers. I remember leaving the bar that night around 12:30, and then I went into a blackout. I always blackout. And I came out of the blackout at 4:30 in the morning, and I'm handcuffed to a chair in the state police barracks, and I'm being interrogated by these two troopers. Troopa Hoopa, I will never forget that man. He was so mean to me. He probably wasn't, but, you know, that was my perception at the time. But I didn't know what happened, you know, but I knew I was in trouble. And They're asking me all these questions, and, you know, I figured that they probably drove me there, considering the pretty metal bracelets. So like a good alcoholic, I asked him, where's my car? And he yelled at me. And he said, I already told you 4 times. It was undrivable after the accident. We had it towed. And then I started to panic because I didn't appear to be injured. I didn't know what I hit or who I hit. I just knew I was in a whole world of trouble, so I shut up. But that was the last time I drank. That was my wake-up call. And I want to make it very clear, it had nothing to do with the arrest or the name in the paper or any of that. I don't think that that kind of stuff scares us. I have a jail commitment today. I spend a lot of time in jail. I feel so sorry for those women. My heart goes out to them. There's no difference between them and me. The only difference is they got caught. I feel like they're doing my time. But it wasn't the arrest that scared me or anything like that. I hit my bottom that night, and people have different opinions about what your bottom is. And it's just my personal opinion. You don't have to take this with you. But I don't think our bottoms have anything to do with losing, you know, the stuff or the jobs or the houses or the spouses. You know, our personal bottom is like a death in our soul. It's like a spiritual death. And that's what happened to me that night. Because after they finished with all my paperwork, they let me go on my own recognizance. Go figure. But they handed me my paperwork, and they pushed the phone across the desk at me. And they said, call someone, come and get you. We're not driving you home. And I stared at that phone for what felt like forever, because I had nobody. I had no one to call. I had burnt every bridge. What little family I have is up in Massachusetts. I'm certainly not going to call the ex-husband to come and get me. I had nobody. And I don't think I have ever felt that depth of lonely. Ever, and I don't ever want to again. The only thing that I did have in my purse was an employee list, everybody that I worked with, you know, for snow days when you're open and late, you call each other, and I called all 35 people that I work with at 5 o'clock in the morning, begging someone to come and get me, and one woman finally took pity on me, and she did. And when I got home, there was a phone book sitting on the coffee table, and I flipped it open to the yellow pages, and luckily we have an easy name, it's right there under A. And I called the AA hotline, and God bless that woman. She got me to a meeting that day. If any of you have ever worked on the hotline, by the way, thank you very much. We are not nice people when we call. This poor woman, I'm like sobbing into the phone, like, I think I have a drinking problem. She's going, oh, you poor thing, honey, what's your name? I thought this was anonymous. You know? Because I was so twisted, I thought that she was going to rat me out to my ex-husband. She knew my ex or something. Anyway, I ended up calling back, and she got me to a meeting, and that was the start of my journey. I thought that that was the worst day of my life. I thought my life was over. No more fun. No going to parties. No going to bars. No meeting guys. There was none of that going on anyway. I don't know what I thought I was missing. But I just thought that I had been sentenced to AA, and I hadn't even been to court yet. I had this horrible, horrible opinion of AA, and I don't know why, because I'd never been to a meeting. I didn't know anyone in the program, but have you ever seen anything on TV or in the movies, anything program-related at all? It's always a dark, dimly lit room, and there's like a circle of folding chairs, and the people sitting in them look like they want to die, right? You know? I always grab the remote and stop it and go, that is not AA. But that's what I thought it was. And I walked into that church, and it was a brightly lit room, and people are laughing and talking and hugging and drinking coffee. And I thought, oh, this is a church thing. I'm in the wrong place. But luckily, they spotted me for a newcomer, and they were like, honey, you're home. Come back, you know. And they were so kind to me. Those people were so nice. They spotted me for a newcomer. They got me a big book. They all wrote their names and phone numbers in them. They told me to keep coming back. They didn't tell me life would get better. They told me I would. And something happened that night. I can't tell you anything about the meeting. I was still so hungover, and everything was really foggy. I don't remember anything anyone said, but I remember how I felt. And I remember when I left the meeting, that's when I had like a major epiphany. I went home after that meeting, and I realized that for that hour I sat in the meeting, my head was quiet, and that never happened sober. Only drunk. And I still don't know what it was. I don't know if it was the message I heard from the speaker. whether it was God I felt in the room, or whether I was in a room full of my own people and I didn't have to wear masks anymore, you know, or maybe it was all of that, I don't know. But I know that I felt better when I left that meeting than I did when I walked in. And the same has held true every meeting that I've been to since. I always feel better when I leave than I do when I walk in. There's something magic that happens here. You know, God lives here. But I didn't do anything right. You guys were telling me what I needed to do. You know, get a sponsor, do the steps, read the big book, you know, get a home group, get a job in your home group. And I was like, yeah, I read them. I got it. I'm good. You know, I sat here and I drank coffee and I smoked cigarettes. That was my first job, washing ashtrays. I'm smoking meetings. I'm dating myself again. I miss those smoking meetings. You didn't even have to light up a cigarette. There was just like a cloud that hovered over the room. All you had to do was stand up and inhale. It was great. But I didn't do anything right. And people were trying to tell me, you know, what to do and how to get better, and I wasn't listening. And I didn't trust any of you. I had serious trust issues. I wouldn't talk to anybody that was my age or younger, because I thought the only reason you'd be nice to me is because you wanted something, because that's how I saw you. If you didn't have anything I wanted, I didn't waste my time on you. But there were these three old guys that sat in the back, and I sat with them all the time. They had about 100 years of recovery together, and they were about 100 years old each. And I knew there was nothing that I had that they wanted, so I trusted them, and I sat with them all the time. And those men would growl at me. They told me the truth, and I thank God they told me the truth. They told me what I needed to hear, not what I wanted to hear. They kept telling me, you know, you need to get with that woman over there. See that woman over there? You need to get with her and do this. And I'm like, her? Ain't going to happen. Hate her. Hate her. And they kept saying, honey, you need help. You can't do this alone. How long are you going to come to a 12-step program and not actually do the thing? I'm like, I come to a meeting every day. And they're like, no. This is the program. You know, there is an actual program. And I'm like, okay, I read them, you know. But they would just shake their heads at me. And because they knew that I was like a walking, talking relapse about to happen. And they didn't know what to do for me. But they would growl at me. God, I would come to the meeting when they were already reading the steps and the preamble and stuff. You know, so I'd get here late. And then as soon as we said the Lord's Prayer, I'd bolt. And they're like, you're missing the meeting before the meeting and the meeting after the meeting. They're more important than the meeting in between. And I'm just looking at them like, you know, I had no clue what they were talking about. I got up and I went to the ladies' room in the middle of a meeting while the speaker was talking. I came back and sat down, and one old guy, we used to call him Popeye, he just looked at me and he growled. He was like, don't ever do that again. What, I can't pee? You know, what's wrong? He said, God sent you here to hear a message. You're going to miss it in the bathroom. Don't ever do that again. Which I thought was highly unreasonable. But like I said, he messed with my program, though. I haven't been to the bathroom since during a meeting. But they were trying to save my life, you know? They were trying to tell me the truth. And they tried to sit me down and talk to me about the steps one day. And after a meeting, he's like, tell me about the first step. And I'm like, oh, jeez. I said, all right, I know it. I got it. I said, I've read it. It says, we admitted we're powerless over alcohol. Our lives have become unmanageable because we drink. And he looked at me and he said, you just added a few words there. It ain't broken, don't fix it. Say it again. We admitted we're powerless over alcohol. Our lives have become unmanageable because we drink. And he said, stop. Stop right there. You're missing it. You're missing the whole point of that step. There's a hyphen in the middle of that sentence. Whenever there's a hyphen in the middle of a sentence, it means there's two separate thoughts. A, you're powerless over alcohol. You know that. You got that. You wouldn't be sitting in a church basement at 8 o'clock every night. If you didn't know, you can never drink again. What you're missing is the second part, the unmanageability. You think that your life is unmanageable because you drink, and you got it backwards. You drink because your life is unmanageable. And again, I'm like, I'm looking at him like he's medicated. Like, what are you talking about, old man? And he said, how much time you got, sweetie? And I was so proud of myself. I whipped out that 6-month coin. I'm like, 6 months. I got this thing, you know? And he's like, 6 months. That's awesome. 6 months since any liquor has passed your lips. If liquor was your only problem, by now your life ought to be just peachy, huh? Mm. And I wanted to punch him in the throat. Because I hate when people are right, you know? Don't you hate that? But he was absolutely right. I hurt worse then than I did the first day I worked in the place, you know? Because you took away my solution. I was the only thing that made it okay to be me. It was the only thing that allowed me to breathe in my own skin. And now I'm like a walking, talking raw nerve. And I'm in so much pain that I don't know what's wrong with me. But I'm thinking, maybe this guy knows what he's talking about. Maybe I need to listen to them. But then they started talking about the higher power thing. And I'm like, you can't fool me. I know you're talking about God, and I don't want to talk about him. You know? I know God. I've known God my whole life. I told you, I was raised in a devout Irish Catholic household. I've known God my whole life, even when I was out there and things were at their worst. He was up there, I was down here, we didn't mess with each other. I liked it that way. Based on mutual indifference, it was beautiful. But the second step says that, you know, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I've always believed in God, and I've always been nuts. So explain that to me. Right? And they probably did a really good job, but I wasn't ready to hear it. They told me that my problem was not that I didn't believe. My problem was I had no faith. And I didn't understand that. But I didn't stick around to find out. I had what I thought were bigger problems at that time in my life. I know today there is nothing more important than my recovery. If I lose that, I lose everything. But at that point in time, I thought I had really serious problems. I had money issues. Not like owing people money. I mean, we all have that. Nobody gets in here on a winning streak, you know? Oh, I just won the lottery. I think I'll go to AA. I had some serious issues, you know? I'm living alone. I'm a single mom. I got these two kids I'm supporting. I'm paying two attorneys now. I got a defense attorney for the DUI, and I've got a divorce attorney because you can't pay the same one to do both because they specialize. And they kind of want their money up front, you know. I've got my little paycheck that I'm supporting these kids on. I've got nothing coming in. We haven't been to court yet. The judge didn't tell him what to pay, so I'm not getting anything. I had to pay to repair the car that I totaled because I let my car insurance lapse. I had better things to do with my money. I had to pay to replace the telephone pole I took out. They don't tell you that you have to replace those, but you do. I got all this money going out, right, and nothing coming in, and I can't afford to feed my kids. I'm doing my grocery shopping at the dollar store. But that was just normal everyday stuff. The thing that was killing me, that was keeping me up at night, Christmas was in just a couple weeks, and I can't afford a tree, let alone put anything under it. And I'm looking at these two beautiful children. My kids are 6 and 7, and I don't know how to tell them Santa's not coming. And I'm losing it, and I don't know what to do. And I went to a meeting one night, and I sat with my little old dudes in the back, and I'm crying, and I told them what was going on. And Popeye looks at me, and he says, "Honey, have you prayed about it?" Yeah, that's what I need, prayer, right? You know, I need cash. Do you know anybody? Does that sponsor lady, does she have money, you know? Can you hook me up with someone? And he's just shaking his head like, you so don't get it. And he said something that I will never, ever forget. It had a profound effect on me. He said, "Mortal man cannot perform miracles. Only God can do that. I suggest you go home and hit your knees." And I didn't know God, and I didn't know how to talk to God. I only knew those memorized prayers from childhood. But I had no other recourse. I had nothing else to do. So I did. I went home, and I said, I think the first honest prayer I ever said in my life. And I said, "God, please spare my kids. They don't deserve this. Please spare my kids." And that was it. And I said that prayer a couple 100,000 times, and nothing happened. And about 10 days went by, and by now I was ready to open a vein. And I pulled into work one morning, and I opened the place. I get the keys to the place. So I'm supposed to be the only car in the parking lot, and there were three cars sitting there running. And I didn't know quite what was going on, but I got out of my car, and when I did, three women got out of those cars, and they came walking towards me. One of them I vaguely recognized. The other two I'd never seen before in my life. They said, "Honey, can you come over? We'd like to show you something." cars were loaded. They bought my kids Christmas. They bought my kids everything you can imagine. Toys and stuffed animals and puzzles and books and videos. Snow parkas and ski pants and boots. Mittens, gloves, stockings full of candy. They even gave me a little envelope with some cash inside so I could buy a tree. Found out later on that that woman that looked familiar was one of us. I'd seen her in a meeting. And the other two women were her mother and her sister. And they were so grateful for what AA had done for her, for getting her back, that they wanted to donate money and we wouldn't take it. We're self-supporting. So this is what they did. Every year they found a family at Christmas, a needy family, and they bought them Christmas. And that year they picked us. I grabbed that woman and I hugged her and I cried all over her. And she said, honey, you can't thank me. I was once in your shoes and this was done for me. So I said, all right, you won't let me thank you, but I'm going to pay you back. You know, it might take me 20 years, but I'm going to pay you back. And she said, no, stop. That's not how it works. She said, you haven't been around long enough, but in AA we don't pay it back. We pay it forward. You keep doing what you're doing. Get with a good sponsor. Work a good program. And one day when you're ready, God will put someone in your path. It'll be your turn to pay it forward. And I swear my feet didn't touch the ground for the rest of the day. Because two important things happened. One, that my faith in humanity was restored. Because I forgot you're all good and kind and loving. Because I was so broken and jaded I couldn't see you. But the other more important thing that happened is that my faith in God was restored. Because I knew who those three women were. They were the answer to a drunk's prayer. I didn't ask for anything for me. I asked God to spare my kids. And he did. There was nothing under that tree that year with my name on it. And I was the richest woman in the world. You know, just looking at those kids' faces. I should have warned you. Menopause is awful. I'm so sorry. Anyway, after that Christmas, I dove in. I dove into this program feet first. I didn't know what you guys had, but I wanted it. I missed it somewhere along the line. And so I got with that woman, that woman that I couldn't stand. I lowered my pride and my ego, and I was like, will you sponsor me? And she said, no. And I was like, what? You know? But she was married. She had a husband. She had three sons. She worked full-time during the day. She was going to nursing school at night. She had a lot of sponsees. Her time was spread really thin, and she said, I will be depriving you of a good experience in AA, and I don't want to do that. She said, but I know a lot of women, and I'll introduce you to someone. And I cried. I was like, you're my last hope. You know, she was the first person I asked. But so she said, I'll be your temporary sponsor. And she sponsored me for the first 5 years of my sobriety. My God, that woman, she saved my life. I love that woman. She started taking me through the book. We went through the whole book. We started on the first page and had writing, and we went through the whole book. We went through all the steps. We went through AA history. We went through the traditions. She taught me everything she knew about the program. But that's not how I learned from her. I told you I have trust issues. I don't listen to what people say. I know how to lie. I can lay it on really thick, you know? I don't listen to words. I don't put a whole lot of weight in them. I watch people's feet. I want to see if their actions are backing up what their mouth is selling. And I thought this woman was full of it. There is no way anybody could be that flippin' happy. That's why I hated her. I couldn't stand her because she was so nauseatingly happy. She's one of those scary happy people. Made me sick to my stomach. But every meeting I went to, they told me, get a sponsor who has what you want. Well, I didn't need a sponsor who had a handsome husband or a big house or a fancy car or clothes or jewelry. I'd had all that. It didn't fix me. She was happy, and I didn't know happy. So I asked her to sponsor me. And the first night I went over her house to do step work, I excused myself to go to the bathroom, and I went to her medicine chest because I was sure she was medicated. I wanted to see what she was on. But I didn't find anything other than Tylenol, so I guess that's what serenity looks like. And then I had to make amends. But I learned from her by watching her, you know? Everywhere we went, and this lady, she was the real deal. She didn't just talk the talk, she walked it. Everywhere we went, every meeting she took me to, she knew every single person in the room. Hated her for that. I mean, really ticked me off. I'm like, how do you do that? How do you know everyone? You know, I want friends. How do you do that? You know? And she said, everywhere we go, I see you getting women's numbers. She says, you've got to have 40 or 50 numbers by now. How many have you called? None. I thought it was for emergencies. And she's like, okay, I'm giving you your first homework. She said, I want you to pick 5 women off that list. I want you to call the same 5 women for the next 10 days straight. And say, what? You know? She said, I don't care. As long as it's not about you. Ask them about them. How their day is going. What's going on in their life. And see, I was terrified because I didn't know how to talk to people. But I was desperate for what you had. And so I took the suggestion and I called, picked 5 names. Called them every day. The first couple calls were brutal because, like I said, I don't know how to talk to people. But as the days went by, you know, we talk about, like, husbands and ex-husbands and jobs and bosses and kids. And we started having, like, real conversations. And it got easier. Anyway, the 10th day came. I made all the calls. And I thought, oh, thank God that's over, you know. Day 11 came and went. I didn't have to call anybody. It was beautiful. No AA police, nothing. It was great. Day 12 came, and my phone blew up, and it was those 5 women, and they wanted to know if I was okay, and why didn't I call the day before, and I realized I had friends, but more important, I realized that if I wanted to have friends, I had to be one first, and that's how she taught me. She let me learn the lessons that I missed along the way, because I was too busy self-medicating, you know. I grew up in AA. I learned by watching all of you guys. You know, I found out that you weren't all a bunch of phonies, that you do really walk the walk, not just talk it. And I learned this beautiful way of life from you. Things did start getting better. Things brightened up. My children weren't afraid of me. My children are my best friends today. My husband's married. I love my daughter-in-law. Adore her. I've got the most wonderful, everybody hates their mother-in-law, right? They invited me on vacation with them last year. Who invites their mother-in-law on vacation? I love my daughter-in-law. I've got a little granddaughter, and I just found out if there's another one on the way. Life got good. Life did not get perfect. That doesn't happen. You know, you don't get struck sober and then, you know, life is all rainbows and unicorns and shit. That just doesn't happen. You know, that's not reality. Life shows up, and that's not God. God doesn't do the bad stuff. That's just life. God gets us through the bad stuff. I've been through some stuff in recovery. I buried my dad. That was brutal. I've had breast cancer twice. That was loads of fun. I 4 years ago, December 21st of 2014, I buried my stepson. I love that kid. When I divorced his dad, he said, you're divorcing my dad. You're not divorcing me. You're still my mom. And I didn't give birth to him, but I loved him like he was mine. And he died of a heroin overdose. He was one of us. And that was really hard. You know, I've spent the better part of the last 17 years trying to help others, and I couldn't reach one of my own. That was difficult. But I'm not telling you the bad things because I want you to think my recovery's been awful. I love my recovery. My life has been amazing. My recovery's been great. That's just stuff that happened along the way. But I told you about that stuff because I'm trying to make a point. I promise I'll get to my point. Remember when I told you I was a little kid, a little girl, you know, walking in the circles and talking to walls and didn't like anyone and no one liked me? Since I've been sober, since I've been in recovery, I haven't ever been alone. I haven't ever been alone. Do you know what a gift that is to someone like me? I have a wonderful relationship with my higher power today. I walk with him and I talk with him every day. I talk to him out loud. My sponsor makes me talk to God out loud. Thank God for the invention of Bluetooth, because I'll be driving down the highway and talking a mile a minute, and I hope people think I'm on the phone. But I'm usually arguing with God about something, having a debate of the day. But God is always with me. And I know that there's nothing I'm going to face in the course of my day that God and I can't get through together. And because crazy comes back quickly, sometimes I have a hard time hearing his voice. And that's when I come here and he talks to me through you. I think that's why I stay so heavily rooted in this program. That's how God has always spoken to me, through the skin faces around me, you know? Something magic that happens here. God lives here. I want to tell you about one thing. I wouldn't feel right if I didn't share it with you. It's one of the greatest gifts I've been given in AA, and I've had many, but I want to share this with you, and then I promise I'll sit down and shut up. When I was about 3 years sober, 3.5 years sober, something like that, I went to a meeting one night. It was a Friday night meeting, and I went in late. You know, they're already reading the preamble, and because I'm late everywhere I go. God has not seen fit to remove that character defect. But anyway, I get to the meeting late, and I sit down next to one of my friends in the back, and I'm doing that inventory thing we do. You know, how you look around the room, and you check out everybody, and, you know, oh, they're holding hands, hooking up, you know, and, you know, you got a haircut, looking good, you know. But I look over, and a couple tables over, there's this young girl that I love. Love this girl. She's early in recovery. I think at that point she was like about 3 or 4 months sober. But she's one of these kids that really gets this thing, you know. She's on fire for the program. Every time I see her, she's spinning by the halfway houses, picking up all the girls, you know. She's got a little Toyota. It's like a clown car. They all jump out. She's tall and blonde and thin and gorgeous and legs up to her armpits. And I mean, she's everything that I always wanted to be. I love this girl. But this night I almost didn't recognize her because she's a train wreck, right? I mean, her face was all puffy and red and swollen. She wasn't crying, but it was obvious she had been. So I lean over to my buddy and I'm like, all right, what's going on over here? Should I talk to her? You know, can I help? And he said, you need to talk to her. Somebody needs to talk to her, but I don't know if you can help. I'm like, all right, well, what am I walking into? What's going on? Relapse? Is it a guy thing? What's, you know? And he said, no, none of that. She's a nice girl. She's a young single mom. She's going through a horrific divorce. She's got no money. She's got two kids. She's having a hard time feeding her kids. We actually have a collection going on in the home group. We're going to go grocery shop and get some food in the house for those kids. He says, you want in on it? And I'm like, been there. Yeah, I want in on it, you know. And I should tell you, I'm a wicked debit card person. I never carry cash. So I pick up, like, my suitcase of a purse, and I'm, like, rifling through my purse looking for anything that I've got in there, any change down the bottom, and everything's coming out, you know, hairbrush, kids inhaler, everything. And he's talking. He's still talking while I'm going at it. And that's when I heard it. He said, that's not what's really upsetting her. What's killing her is that Christmas is in a couple weeks. So my heart stopped. I have a friend up in Boston that always says that God does not need our permission to use us. And we very seldom know when he is. And I know my friend had no idea that God was talking through him that night. But I've learned to recognize God's voice. And I knew it was my turn to pay it forward. So anyway, I gave him what little money I found, and I said, you go take care of the grocery thing. I got the other thing. And I bolted. As soon as the meeting was over, I never did talk to her. But Target was open. I had to get there. You know, so I went shopping, and I burned up a credit card. I love spending money, especially when it's for other people, you know. I bought everything for those kids that haven't bought for mine. You know, all the stuffed animals and the toys and the games and the puzzles and the videos and the books and snow pockets and ski boots and ski pants and boots. And I gave her a little envelope full of cash so she could go buy herself a tree. And I made 100 phone calls and I found out where she lived. And I went over the next morning and the kids were awake. They were watching cartoons, you know. So I called her out and I said, I need you to look at my car. And she's looking at the car and she's looking at me and she's looking at the car and she doesn't get it. And I'm such a bitch. I let her figure it out. But when it finally hit her, it just ran her over like a train, you know. She did the same thing I did. She fell apart, started sobbing, grabbed me, tried to thank me. And I was like, you can't thank me. I was once in your shoes. this was done for me. And then she wanted to pay me back. She wanted to clean my house and do my laundry, and you know, and I'm like, whoa, it doesn't work that way. But I was blessed enough that I got to tell her what those three women had told me 3 years before. You know, in AA, we don't pay it back. We pay it forward. Keep working the program. You know, do what you're doing. One day when you're ready, God will put someone in your path, and it'll be your turn. And we had fun trying to smuggle everything in the house because the kids were up, and so we had to, like, divert them, and the other one would run upstairs, and we had a ball. But she walked me out to my car, and we wished each other Merry Christmas, and we hugged and started to drive away. She's still sober. I still get a Christmas card from her every year, and she finally did get a chance to pay it back a couple of years ago. Pay it forward, I should say. But that wasn't the gift that I was given. The gift that I wanted to tell you about happened after, when I was driving home, and I was thinking about her and wondering what was going through her head, you know, because I knew what was going through her head. I was her, you know. I'd been there. She thought that she got the gift that day. But now I knew what those three women knew. You know, that I was the one that got the gift. Finally figured out what you guys have been trying to tell me my whole life. It's not in the receiving, it's in the giving. It's about helping each other. That's all God wants from us, is to take care of each other. God gives us the most incredible gifts in our lives, and you want so badly to pay him back, but he's God. He's got everything. You can't buy him anything. All he wants from us is to take care of that which is most important to him, each other, you know, just helping one person at a time. It's not about sponsoring mountains of people. I've been there, wanted to be the queen of AA, tried to save everyone, you know, helping whoever's in front of you, just helping one suffering alcoholic. I don't know what's going on up here, but down where I live in Maryland, people are dropping like flies. People are dying left and right. I'm spending way too much time in funeral homes. And I always ask myself, did I do enough? You know? Why can't we see each other? I won't get off on that tangent, but my life has changed so drastically just by living this way, living according to spiritual principles, staying close to God, and trying to help someone else. I don't need alcohol and drugs or men or food or anything else that I used to use to try and fill the hole in my soul. I don't need to self-medicate anymore because I'm free. Thinking about you relieves me of the bondage of self. And I just try to help whoever's in front of me. And life has gotten amazing. I'm working on my bucket list. I'm doing all kinds of things that because I don't want to get too old to not be able to do anything on it, you know? So I went swimming with dolphins in Cozumel, Mexico. I went whitewater rafting with my home group. I tried to learn how to snowboard. I went up to New Hampshire. I learned how to roll down a hill really well. But I tried, you know? I went skydiving. Did I tell you about that? My fat ass jumping out of a plane. It was awesome. It was exhilarating. I'm living today. Before I got here, I was just existing, just getting through another day, you know? You guys taught me how to live, and it's an incredible life. And I don't have any of the answers, but I know one thing. If you don't feel about your recovery the way I've been talking about mine, you are missing it. You're selling yourself short. You need to get with one of those happy, nauseatingly people, you know, the scary, happy people. You need to get with them and hang on to them like your life depends upon it. Because it does. I've talked way too long. God bless you. Thank you.